During the month of December, we deck our halls and don apparel in the festive colors of red and green. But when it comes to holiday shopping, financial advisors say if you're smart, you'll stick with the green and stay out of the red. Here to discuss the dangers of December debt and the January hangover is NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Welcome back.
Good morning, Leanne.
We're right in the heart of gift buying season right now. How are consumers paying for their purchases?
And with the economy and the kind of bad shape that it's still in, you'd think that people would be avoiding their credit cards. But in fact, we're seeing individuals pile up more debt, especially on their department store credit cards. Now, from the credit card industry's perspective, total debt actually is down a little bit. But that's because stores and banks themselves have closed so many of those accounts, especially on their weakest customers. And a lot of people have closed the accounts themselves. So altogether, we're down about 18% on our cards. But for the individuals who still have them open, those debts are actually higher. The average balance per consumer on a single store credit card is about $198 now, and that's $30 more than it would have been last year at the same time.
How well are people handling their debts to these store credit cards, these retailers?
We know that they're not handling it all that well, because you can see the percentage of people paying late payments to the stores has actually risen significantly in the past year. So we know people are getting hit with more fees and they're paying higher interest rates.
Why open department store credit cards in the first place? I mean, can't all purchases be charged to a bank credit card?
It's true. You could just use that general purpose MasterCard and Visa card anytime you go into a Nordstrom's or a Lord & Taylor's. But we get lured into these store credit cards because they offer us discounts and reward points. But I was talking with Michelle Ranieri, who's an analyst with Experian. That's a firm that studies credit card use. She said people are using their department store credit cards more this year, not just because of those discounts, but because they don't have room for more debt on their bank cards. So they end up using a Macy's card to buy the Christmas present, and then they buy lunch with their bank credit card. And that helps spread your debt around so you don't hit the credit limit.
But is that really a sensible strategy?
It's certainly a tempting one. Anybody can understand at this time of year you want to shop. And the trouble comes in when it gets to be January and you've got bills piling up. You've got fees, interest payments. It really is a lot more financially sensible to stick to cash in December. Of course, now the retailers are hoping that we will use a lot of plastic because they would like an exuberant shopping season. And certainly it's true. In the short term, a lot of buying right now would make the economy look healthier. But financial planners say that it's just kind of crazy to take on more debt when the job market is still so dicey. To have a sustainable economic recovery over time, it's really better to be more conservative.
Reduce the personal debt and boost up our savings. All right. So, but Marilyn, if someone wants to kick the debt habit, is it advisable to close all credit accounts except for one bank credit card?
It's strange. You'd think that if you closed all your credit cards, that would show that you're really making a commitment to financial responsibility. But actually, the financial planners say that it's the opposite. If you make any sudden moves where you either open a lot of accounts or you close a lot of accounts, it makes you sort of look suspicious for some reason. So the better strategy is if you want to start closing those credit cards, just do it slowly and over time.
Marilyn G. Wax is NPR's Senior Business Editor. Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Leanne.
Bobby Bowden, longtime head football coach at Florida State University, winner of 12 Atlantic Coast Conference titles and 2 national titles, has announced his retirement. Essayist and lifelong fan Diane Roberts says it isn't quite the valedictory people wanted.
In the end, it wasn't pretty. The 80-year-old man, accustomed to hearing himself called brilliant, possibly the greatest college coach in the history of the game, a legend even, was forced to confront reality. His team had had yet another undistinguished season. Fans, boosters, and alumni whispered it at first, then said it louder and louder. Maybe he just doesn't have it anymore. Maybe it's time for him to go. Last weekend, after the Seminoles lost big to their old arch rival, the University of Florida, he said he needed to do some soul searching. Whatever he found there led him to believe that it was time to leave the game that had been his passion, his life, for more than 50 years. Lately, he had become detached, sometimes even petulant. There is something Shakespearean in Bobby Bowden's fall from football grace, something reminiscent of Richard III's denial that the war was lost, or perhaps King Lear's refusal to see that his pride endangered the whole kingdom. The line between self-confidence and hubris is spider silk thin. The university named the football field after him. They erected a bronze statue of him. At the north end zone of the stadium, there's a stained glass window of him, three stories high. Bobby Bowden, St. Bobby we used to call him, is right up there with Jesus around here. When Bobby Bowden came to FSU, the team was lousy, to put it charitably. He ignited the Seminoles, turning them into national stars, playing the big boys of Nebraska, Notre Dame, and Michigan on the road, inventing weird and ingenious plays such as the fumble-rooski and the punt-rooski. Like his fellow Alabamian Bear Bryant, he had excellent football manners, gracious in victory and gracious in defeat. He was a masterpiece of charm and cunning, a virtuoso of that old Southern trick where you make like you ain't the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree, suckering your opponent, then going for the kill. His players loved him. He produced two Heisman Trophy winners, many Biletnikoff and Thorpe Award winners, armies of All-Americans, squads of pro players, a Rhodes Scholar, and countless regular guys. He was a teacher. This is the Bobby Bowden we want to remember.
Diane Roberts teaches at Florida State University in Tallahassee. This is NPR News. As healthcare overhaul legislation advances through the Senate, lawmakers are debating a number of proposals and amendments, including an effort to increase the number of primary care physicians across the country. If the health care bill is approved, more than 30 million Americans would be covered, and some fear there aren't enough family doctors to meet the anticipated need. Dr. Atul Grover is the Chief Advocacy Officer for the Association of American Medical Colleges, and he's in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York reportedly plans to introduce an amendment to the health care bill that would add funding for 2,000 medical residency spots in order to get more primary care physicians into the pipeline. Will that be effective?
I think it's a good start. The problem is that we're facing, even without significant expansion in insurance coverage, a shortage of somewhere between 125,000 and 150,000 physicians by the year 2025. And why that's important now is because you can't just pull doctors off the shelf. We're talking about, on average, 10 years to train and educate them. So it's something we need to think about now.
Well, why are some senators opposed to the idea of more of these slots?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to money, and we know that they have had a tough time keeping the total budget for the health care reform package under the limit set by the president of $900 billion. Now, from that standpoint, when we're talking about an additional 15,000 slots, which is what we'd really like to see come out of the legislation, that'd be about an extra $1 billion a year, or $10 or $12 billion over 10 years. That's a big amount of money, but if you think about it in the context of what Medicare spends every year, somewhere close to $500 billion on medical care, it doesn't seem like a lot to spend to ensure that there are actually physicians out there to care for Medicare beneficiaries and the rest of the American public.
So what will happen if an additional 30 million Americans get added to the health care rolls if they're already now are too few primary care doctors?
Well, I think it's going to be tough for everybody, but particularly for people who are already underserved. And those are people who are living in rural areas or people who are already financially underserved, don't have insurance. We're going to get to a lot of them, but not all of them. And it's important to note that we're not just going to have a shortage of primary care physicians. We're about a third of those docs that we're going to be shorter in primary care. But the other two-thirds are going to be across the range of specialties because essentially anybody that cares for the elderly is going to be in short supply. We're talking about really doubling the number of people over 65 in the next 15 years or so. And that's going to be just a really unprecedented amount of demand for medical care.
I'm speaking with Atul Grover, Chief Advocacy Officer for the Association of American Medical Colleges. Suppose these spots open up for new medical students. How do you maintain the quality of medical care? you're opening up a lot more slots. And there's an old joke, you know, if you graduate last in your class and become a doctor, what are you called? And you're still called a doctor.
Right.
How do you maintain quality?
There are a lot more qualified people who are applying to medical school right now than there are actually spaces for. And that's why our members have committed to expanding by 30% over the next two decades to make sure that we have enough physicians to take care of the U.S. population, but without an increase in residency training programs that really completes their training, we're not going to have enough physicians. So we believe that there's a very, very strong applicant pool out there right now, and our data would indicate that even if we expanded by 30%, we would not see any decline in the quality of physicians being produced.
Why is it that you think more medical students are choosing to go into specialty fields of medicine as opposed to primary care, for example, cosmetic surgeon?
I think, you know, it's probably a pretty complicated issue when you think about anybody and their specialty choice or their professional careers and how they make those decisions. There are certainly financial issues, particularly when medical students are looking at, by the end of training now, an average of $150,000, $160,000 in loans. So if you have two physicians getting married, they essentially are starting out with a pretty big mortgage without even having a house. I would say that because of the vast disparities in reimbursement and the smaller degree of hassle for cosmetic procedures, you will certainly see that whether it's primary care physicians doing Botox injections or plastic surgeons doing more elective cosmetic procedures than reconstructive, there certainly is a push in that direction because of the reimbursement incentives.
Dr. Atul Grover is the Chief Advocacy Officer for the Association of American Medical Colleges. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leah.
You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. When Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein last appeared on our program in 2007, they had just published their book, Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar. They told jokes to illustrate philosophy. Here's Cathcart with one about the meaning of life.
A seeker has heard that the wisest guru in all of India lives atop India's highest mountain. So the seeker treks over hill and Delhi until he reaches the fabled mountain. It's incredibly steep, and more than once he slips and falls. By the time he reaches the top, he's full of cuts and bruises, but there's the guru, sitting cross-legged in front of his cave. Oh, wise guru, the seeker says, I have come to ask you what the secret of life is. Ah, yes, the secret of life, the guru says. The secret of life is a teacup. A teacup? I came all the way up here to find the meaning of life, and you tell me it's a teacup? The guru shrugs. So maybe it isn't a teacup.
Thomas Cathcart, who has dropped out of various divinity schools, and Daniel Klein, who has written jokes for Flip Wilson and Lily Tomlin, have just published a new book, this time about the afterlife. It's called Heidegger and a Hippo, Walk Through Those Pearly Gates. Both former philosophy students are in our New York bureau. Welcome back, Thomas and Daniel.
Thanks, Leanne.
Great to be here.
So what is it that led you to explore death? Was it a natural offshoot of your Plato book?
Well, it sort of turns out that philosophy about death is sort of an intro to philosophy of life. All of these philosophers that we explore in the book actually took the point of view that you can't really look at life and the meaning of life without looking at the fact that it ends.
Yeah, if you lived for an eternity, there'd be a whole different set of questions and options for you. What we've noticed is that most of the philosophers of life and death come from Germany or Denmark, as in the case of Kierkegaard, France, as in the case of Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus. And there's nobody on the Riviera who's writing about this stuff.
In fact, a gold mine, it turns out, of jokes about death is Scandinavia, particularly the Oli and Lena jokes.
Sure. Have one, right? I know you
do.
Have one.
So Oli dies. So Lena goes down to the Minneapolis Star to report it to the obituary writer. And the writer says, well, tell me what you want to say, Lena. And Lena says, oh, just say Oli died. And the writer says, well, gee, Lena, you know, you live together 50 years. You have children. You have grandchildren. Oli was very well loved in the community. Surely you must want to say something more than that. And if it's money you're worried about, don't worry. The first five words are free. So Lena says, oh, okay. put Ole died, boat for sale.
Well, Soren Kierkegaard, whom you call the melancholy Dane, yes. I mean, his attitude about death was go through with it, deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said face your mortality, and that will make your life, your real life, come out in relief. Then you'll really know what's at stake every minute of your life. So he was a philosopher of life and of seeking transcendence. He wasn't, you know, just dwelling on the fact that we're going to die, but he thought that's a necessary component.
I'm speaking with Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein about their new book, Heidegger and a Hippo, Walk Through Those Pearly Gates. Sigmund Freud named the fear of death one of the factors that drive humans to create and defend the illusion of gods and religion. And you refer to a father figure in the sky, and you nickname him Sky Daddy. this idea that, well, there must be something bigger than ourselves and something after this mortal coil. How do you treat Sigmund Freud and his view?
I try to treat him very tenderly. but one of the things that we realized in talking about Freud that, you know, it's by group consciousness, it's by reinforcement of groups that we're able to sustain these religious delusions about immortal life.
Plato is someone who turns up in this book as well. He was the star of your first book, Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar. You call Plato the godfather of soul. And basically what we're talking about is the rise of dualism, the idea that one's mind or soul exists outside the body.
Plato was very much, he was sort of one of the initiators of that school of thought, that the soul is what animates the body. It's what gives rise to reason. Everything that isn't the body, he thought, was the soul. And he thought, actually, that that's the part that's immortal, that keeps on going after the body dies and disintegrates.
You take death in the afterlife, and you take a look at it from all different angles, you know, from what the older philosophers said, and even coming right up until, you know, the edge of the 21st century. Because I have to ask, what is modern science, the ability to extend, improve, preserve, perhaps even duplicate life, added to the canon of philosophy about death?
Oh, it raises all kinds of... I mean, they even have a name for these guys. They're called bio-immortalists. And, you know, they're the guys who think they can freeze you until they find a cure for whatever did you in and then reanimate you or thaw you out. But the most interesting ones who are these guys who say they can download your entire nervous system and everything in it, every memory, every like and dislike, onto a computer chip and then replicate that and keep it around forever. So you would exist as a computer chip. The one thing they can't do is reverse aging.
Yeah. For Danny and me, we're 70 years old. You know, for us to become immortal, we'd be 70 forever. Because the one thing they haven't figured out how to do is sort of rewind the aging clock. You know, it's like the guy who was walking along in the woods and all of a sudden he sees a frog on the ground and the frog suddenly speaks to him.
This is an old guy, right?
An old guy. And the frog says, old man, if you pick me up and kiss me, I turn into a princess and we can make love all night long. So the old man bends down and picks him up, sticks him in his pocket, and continues walking. The frog says, hello, hello, old man. He says, I don't think you heard me. He said, you have to kiss me, then I become a beautiful princess, and we make love all night. The old man says, no, I heard you, Froggy. It's just at my age, I'd rather have a talking frog.
So who wants to go out with the joke that's the title of your book, Thomas or Daniel?
Oh, Danny, take it away.
Heidegger and a Hippo. Oh, by the way, this joke has a direct, actual quote from Heidegger in it. Heidegger and a Hippo stroll up to the pearly gates, and St. Peter says, listen, we've only got room for one more today, so whoever of the two of you gives me the best answer to the question, what is the meaning of life, gets to come in. And Heidegger says, to think being itself explicitly requires disregarding being to the extent that it is only grounded and interpreted in terms of beings and for beings as their ground, as in all metaphysics. But before the hippo can grunt one word, St. Peter says to him, Today's your lucky day, hippie.
Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein are co-authors of the new book, Heidegger and a Hippo Walk Through Those Pearly Gates, and they joined us from our studios in New York. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Leanne.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks very much.
I'm Guy Raz, and I'm rolling out the welcome mat for our movie critic, Bob Mondello. That's Bob Psycho Killer Mondello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we're playing the Psycho theme music for a reason, Bob. We actually asked you to be with us on the weekends this month to talk about some of the more intriguing moments in film from the past 10 years. Not top 10 lists,
thank
right?
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. So today we asked you to come up with some of the decade's most notable screen villains. Now, Bob, what sort of characteristics does a good movie villain have to have?
Well, if you think about this the same way Shakespeare did, for instance, a villain is someone who's just like the hero. He has all kinds of reasons for what he believes, and they're good reasons. They're good to him. They may not be good to the rest of society. So, therefore, he becomes kind of empathetic. You actually care about him and his reasons for doing things. Think about, for instance, Heath Ledger as the Joker in The Dark Knight. He's a cartoon villain who's more than a cartoon. Take some of those weirdly diametrically opposed origin myths that he was spouting for his sliced up smile. Remember, he has that horrible smile. Here, the Joker explains how he got those scars as his drunken father was killing his mother.
He turns to me and he says, "Why so serious?" He comes at me with the knife. "Why so serious?" Sticks the blade in my mouth. Let's put a smile on that face. And why so serious?
Oh. Now, you see how you were feeling sorry for him when he's telling that story? And that's I think that's the point. The villain needs to have a real reason for what he's doing. Mm.
Okay, let's look at a real-life villain for a moment. It seems that some of the worst characters in real life make for some of the best movie subjects.
Well, that's certainly true of some. I mean, I think Idi Amin, for instance, in The Last King of Scotland, who was really grim.
Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah, he was absolutely great in it. And Charlize Theron as the serial killer Eileen Wuornos in 2003's Monster.
People kill each other every day. And for what? For politics. For religion. And they're heroes. No. No, there's a lot of I can't do anymore. But killing's not one of them. And letting those bastards out there go and rape somebody else isn't either.
No, Lee, that was one man. They can't all have been bad.
You know me. You think I could do it otherwise? I'm not a bad person. I'm a real good person, right?
That was such a creepy portrayal.
And the thing is, I mean, you know, she had to make herself ugly for the role.
Yeah.
An attractive serial killer would not have flown somehow. But there's an interesting thing going on there about a star who sort of transforms herself into someone ugly, both inside and out. But who still, she's accustomed to making characters who you care about. And so you did care about that character deeply as you're watching it. She's a fascinating villain.
You know, some of the scariest villains that I've seen over the past decade are these sociopath types, these guys that are just totally cool, that seem to have absolutely no moral compass.
Right, where you can't figure out what they are thinking, which is, so the empathy isn't flowing sort of naturally. The one this decade that really got to me was Tom Cruise in Collateral. He was a contract killer.
Yeah.
And he, at one point, the clip we have comes right after he has thrown somebody off a rooftop, and he's talking to his taxi driver.
What did he do to you?
Nothing, I only met him tonight.
You just met him once and you kill him like that?
What, I should only kill people after I get to know them?
No.
Max, 6 billion people on the planet, you're getting bent out of shape because of one fat guy.
Well, who was he?
What do you care? Have you ever heard of Rwanda?
Yes, I know Rwanda.
Well, tens of thousands killed before sundown. Nobody's killed people that fast since Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Did you bat an eye, Max?
What?
Did you join Amnesty International, Oxfam, Save the Whale, Greenpeace, or something? No. I offer one fat Angelino and you throw a hissy fit.
Ooh.
You know, villains also are wonderfully articulate. The kind of nice thing about them is that
they're always intelligent.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the idea of a twisted genius is part of this. What you do when you look at an Iago in Shakespeare, in Othello, is you try and figure out why. Why is he doing this? I think that's what almost always is what's interesting about villains.
And Bob, we should stress that this list that we've put together in no way is comprehensive. We didn't talk about Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm. or Daniel Day-Lewis in Gangs of New York. There are too many over the past decade.
No, there have been a lot. And I have a zillion favorites. Actually, I hope our listeners do too, and that they will scribble in something to our website.
I hope they do. Bob Mondello reviews films for this program, and as he just mentioned, we want to hear from you. Tell us some of your picks from the past decade at npr.org. And Bob, I know some people think critics are villains, but please stop wearing that Joker makeup around the office, okay?
I'm a sweetheart. I'm a total sweetheart, I promise.
Isaac Newton is best known for the laws of motion. But when he was still an obscure scientist in 1671, he published a groundbreaking study into the qualities of refracted light.
Therefore it comes to pass that whiteness is the usual color of light. For light is a confused aggregate of rays endued with all sorts of colors, as they are
promiscuous. The words of Isaac Newton, as read by actor John Lescoe. Newton's study was published by the Royal Society in London, the premier scientific academy of its day. The society is about to turn 350 years old, and in celebration, leading scientists have picked 60 papers published over the course of its history and put them online in the original manuscript form. Michael Thompson is a fellow at the Royal Society, and he headed up that committee that chose the papers. He's in Cambridge, England. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Pleased to be with you.
Tell me, how did you come up with this list of 60 papers?
Well, we had a small committee, altogether about 16 people, and we got our heads together and we were trying to cover pretty well everything that had been published, which, of course, you realise is an enormous task. Mm. But we went for what we thought were intriguing and novel, and also the big solid ones. We have, for example, a paper by Stephen Hawking on black holes. Mm. Now, that's not the sort of thing you would read in the train in the morning. In fact, I don't think you would read it at all. It's full of mathematics.
Well, let's start with the oldest paper that you chose. It's by Robert Boyle, and he was actually one of the creators of the Royal Society, right?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And in this paper, he is talking about using experiments of blood transfusions from dogs.
Whether by this way of transfusing blood, the disposition of individual animals of the same kind may not be much altered, as whether the blood of a mastiff being frequently transfused into a bloodhound or a spaniel will not prejudice them in point of scent.
Michael Thompson, this, of course, was written in the 17th century by Robert Boyle, but to basically paraphrase what he's saying if you take the blood from one animal and put it into another, you might be able to alter that animal's behavior, you know, change a spaniel into a mastiff, for example. This was pretty sophisticated science at the time, right?
Well, yes. These were the sort of things they were trying out. In fact, the early years of the Royal Society's publications were full of things like this. They didn't really know which were the things, in a sense, really worth doing. And they were trying everything, looking at all sorts of curiosities.
There's another paper. This is actually a letter that Benjamin Franklin wrote that was published by the Royal Society. And he is talking about an experiment with a kite and lightning. I want to play some tape of our actor John Lescoe, this time, I should note, without the fake British accent.
The kite is to be raised when a thunder gust appears to be coming on, which is very frequent in this country. And the person who holds the string must stand within a door or window or under some cover, so that the silk ribboned may not be wet. As soon as any of the thunderclouds come over the kite, the pointed wire will draw the electric fire from them, and the kite, with all the twine, will be electrified.
So, Michael Thompson, this is a famous story that every schoolchild in America learns about. Ben
That's
Franklin,
right, yes.
You know, tying a key to the end of a kite string.
Yeah. Incidentally, I just wanted to comment that, as I'm sure in the USA, the UK has a lot of worry these days about health and safety. Mm. And I was very amused that the Royal Society added to one of its documents that some of these experiments are dangerous and should not be repeated. He may have had that one in mind.
Yeah. Michael Thompson, I want to end with Mozart, because I found it curious that a description of Mozart as this young musical genius is actually in the Royal Society's collection of papers.
Whilst he was playing to me, a favorite cat came in, upon which he immediately left his harpsichord. Nor could we bring him back for a considerable time. He would also sometimes run about the room with a stick between his legs, by way of horse. I found likewise that most of the London musicians were of the same opinion with regard to his age, not believing it possible that a child of so tender years could surpass most of the masters in that science.
It's a very, very interesting letter written by Daines Barrington. Was this normal? Was it common to sort of write profiles on people who were thought to be geniuses? Because this isn't really scientific inquiry, is it?
Well, I suppose it was, and I suppose you could argue that it is. In fact, as I say, in those days, science hadn't really settled down into its rather, well, possibly even straight-laced approach these days. It wasn't quite clear what was valid to be studied. And given that this was the great spirit of inquiry era, when it was decided to test everything by experiment and see what there was in the world, then this was just the sort of thing they were doing. You just sense the excitement, I think, really, by reading some of these early volumes of the Transactions.
Michael Thompson is a fellow of the Royal Society. Michael Thompson, thanks so much for taking the time.
Many thanks indeed.
And before we let you go, do you like Marmite?
I'm not a tremendous fan of Marmite, no.